stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's IBM teleconference entitled Best Practices for Managing the Performance of Composite Applications. Today's teleconference will last approximately 60 minutes and will include a live question and answer session. This teleconference will guide you through the principles of managing composite applications and introduce solutions for making this part of your IT processes. The teleconference will be hosted by John Knutson, Web Service Management, IBM Software Group.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is John Knutson, and I'm a market manager for IBM Tivoli. I'm responsible for web services management and have recently brought to market IT Canva SOA, which is one of the products that I'll talk a little bit about later on in the presentation. With the session entitled Managing the Performance of Composite Applications, you might think that the first thing to do is to start about management, but really what you'd need to do is take a step back and recognize where the performance problems come from. They don't just appear suddenly when an application is being deployed, though some of them may, but a lot of them are built in along the way. And what I'm going to talk about here is the best way to get them out before they appear. Now, performance and the availability problems which come with it, this is on slide 3, these are no longer just a problem for the internal users of a company's IT systems. In the old days, everybody complained internally about performance and response time, but the internal employees of a company masked those response time problems from their clients, from their partners. But today, with online systems, you know, the prevalent way of deploying IT, direct access to a computer system from a customer, from a partner, has a direct effect on that customer. And if you continually go to a website, or you even go once to a website, and it doesn't perform or it fails in the middle of a transaction, then typically you don't go back there again. And what happens is that enterprise, that company's revenue suffers, their market share suffers, their brand equity suffers if they do it badly, or if, you know, in the case of some of the major banks and brokerage houses, they have compliance regulations raised against them, then you know, they can suffer in a bad way. Now, these performance problems, as I said, they're typically discovered late when a system is being deployed, but they're usually created early. And what I'm going to try and do today is to give you some best practices that can help you to winkle out these performance problems earlier in the life cycle so that they don't cause the problems, you know, later on. For example, you know, problems that only appear under load conditions can be determined during an effective load test. If you have a good understanding of the performance and capacity requirements of your application during a system test and performance test, you can then better understand what sort of hardware you need and what sort of network you might need in order to deploy it successfully. When you set service level agreements with your internal and external users, you want to have a reasonable understanding that the service levels you're promising them for a system which you may be deploying shortly, you know, is the response time that they're likely to get when they start using that system. And you have to plan also not just for the normal run-of-the-mill workload, but you have to plan for traffic peaks, which may come unexpectedly and may come regularly on a seasonal basis. For example, Christmas comes every year. And also you want to plan for future growth, and most businesses really want to plan for future growth. You know, a business which isn't thinking about future growth probably isn't going to be around anyway. And you may want to identify thresholds that you can use in a production monitoring environment so that you can then generate alerts based on something which is reasonable rather than based on you not having a very good idea of what the likely response time is, and therefore maybe you set them too high or you set them too low and you get a lot of false positive results. So all of this together should help you to avoid those performance and availability problems, or the performance-related availability problems that can interfere with your firm's business. Now, if you look on the next slide, you see this is an RUP development process going through the various phases where design decisions are made, implementation decisions are made, and deployment decisions are made. And what Gartner found is as you move through those phases, it can take from 80 to 1,000 times more in terms of resources, in terms of either people resources or money resources to actually remove those problems, you know, remove the defects. And if these are performance defects, you know, you want to get them out as soon as you can. The diagram at the bottom of the screen 4 shows as you move through, you know, the implementation, through into the test, into the production environment, when it's in the test environment, it's your last chance. Even if you don't do the things I'm going to talk about early in the life cycle, don't forget to do the testing, because it's your last chance to find those problems. And when you look at some of the problems, this was an IBM WebSphere study, it found that 64% of the problems are application-related. You know, of that, there's a lot in customer code, there's a lot in the setup, and there's a lot in getting access to the back-end resources. And when we're talking about composite applications, we're almost always talking about some sort of back-end resource, whether it's a CICS back-end resource, an SAP system, a Siebel system, or a business partner system. It's some sort of back-end resource. But they're discovered late. You know, Gartner recently asked, you know, what happens when you roll out an application? 34% said it worked fine in testing. Some crossed their fingers and toes. Some have their IT systems overwhelmed with calls. Only 14% said it met all tested and expected response time measurements and users were happy. Now, 36% didn't seem to be particularly happy with their new IT system. That's the cost of not finding the problems earlier in the life cycle. Moving on to architecture and design on slide 8, it all starts with the requirements gathering. You need to gather not only the functional requirements, what methods, what objects you need to create, what business functions they're going to support, but also what the usage scenarios will be, what the scaling requirements are going to be. And you need to be able to map this into the business requirement and understand what the value of that business requirement is. Because the money that you need to spend in order to do effective performance testing and consider performance from early in the life cycle, it has to be factored in. And if, you know, the business case for the application which is being deployed should be able to support the performance test as well. Now, application types are important. If you don't really have a good understanding of the type of application, or if you have a high-level understanding of the type of application, then I'm going to provide some best practices which tell you the sorts of scenarios or the architectures that you might want to consider when you're deploying those applications. And then I'm going to look at some architectures, some deployment architectures around J2E and composite applications. Slide 9 has a list of 5 different composite application types. I'm going to talk about 2 here in the course of the presentation, and if you follow the links on the screen, they'll take you to the other slides at the back of the presentation. So looking at online trading, what you typically find is there's a high volume of highly complex transactions, probably the most complex environment around. Typically, the applications are connected to legacy systems. Typically, they have very high security requirements, because often they're responsible for very large amounts of money, you know, millions and billions of dollars, you know, go through this sort of system. Typically not much search traffic going on. People know what they want to do in the online trading business. But its information is very time sensitive. You want to know what the market position is now. You want to know what the price of this is now. The price it was 5 seconds ago even isn't really valid in a highly volatile market. So time-sensitive information is critical. And the volumes change. You know, on a busy day, you can be 10 times as busy as you are on a quiet day. People are on for a long time, so the sessions and the data that's associated with those sessions builds up, and you need to plan for that. Now, one of the aspects or the impact of having time-sensitive information is that you can't really cache very much data. In the real world, you probably aren't going to be caching much data, because you've always got to go and bring new information in. So what it means is you really need to have a very large population of both clients and of data in your testing database environment to ensure that when you start to exercise such a system in a test environment, you aren't going to get optimistically good results, because all the data has been cached by either the EGB system or by the database system. Similarly, because of the high security, you'll find that you might have a lot of pages which are being encrypted, and you may want to consider things like hardware encryption engines or even an SOA appliance like a data power appliance, which will help to offload the expense of XML parsing from the main processors, as well as providing federated identity capabilities and XML firewalls, which, you know, you certainly want to have, you know, that sort of protection on such a system like this. So that's online trading. The next slide talks about B2B trading, where typically you have far lower utilization, regularly constant traffic volumes, and fewer transactions, and probably not as complicated either. They're probably going to be integrated as well with legacy backends, often multiple backends, because they're driving purchasing systems, and they're driving accounts payable systems, and they're driving all sorts of systems, and these are often in different packages. You often find that you have a large number of logged on users as well. So again, you've got some caching capabilities, you've got some security requirements, again, some federated identity requirements, which may require some SSL encryption processing, and you may want to find ways to offload that. B2B trading often use web services, and the orders they send back and forth may contain large amounts of data, and you may want to, you know, recognize that you need some additional XML processing, or you need to find ways of reducing the XML overhead in such large messages. And when you have large messages with long sessions, then you need a lot of space in order to keep all your session data and find a way to manage that in a high availability environment. So there we've looked at two different application types, and there's three others to look at in the backup. Now we're going to look at how systems in a composite environment typically are laid out. You typically come in through the internet into an environment either from a client device, Windows environment, for example, or from a web services client, which is probably an application running on another system. Web services traffic like that is more and more these days being brought in through an appliance tier, where the appliance is running between the edge firewall and the main firewall in the DMZ effectively. These appliances can provide XML security capabilities, can do XML parsing at the edge of the network, can convert XML messages into non-XML messages and route them onwards into the system, either to business tier servers running products like WebSphere Process Server for business process execution, through integration tier servers using technologies like MQ Series and messaging and JMS, and products like WebSphere Message Broker, into resource tier servers, which might be WebSphere application servers running on distributed or mainframe platforms, or can be CICS, IMS, DB2 systems, and a range of other systems. So this is a typical environment, and where I've shown one integration tier server, there may actually be multiple organized in a variety of topologies, and similarly, the resources are not all nicely shown in one box, but these are distributed, and typically our customers have very complex environments built in this sort of fashion. But you don't have to start that way. If you look on slide 13, you know, you have a very simple J2E-based architecture pattern. The clients come in through a firewall. You have a presentation tier where you serve their web pages and static content, and then you pass the servlet request that comes into the resource tier, and that's where all the applications are, and that's where the data is. So you can build a relatively simple, this doesn't scale too well as it stands, but, you know, this is a good way to start deploying J2E systems. More typically, though, on slide 14, you'd have a clustered environment. Clustered because you need more than one machine to do all the work. You need more than one machine to serve the web pages, to serve the servlets. You need more than one machine to do the processing of the business processes, of the applications, of the integration, whatever it is you're doing. Now, you typically do this in two ways. You adopt a vertical scaling approach where you add additional components to an existing system. You add CPUs, you add memory, so that you've just got a bigger box. Now, maybe in that bigger box, you still need to do some software scaling as well. You need more than a single JVM in order to take advantage of the multiple CPUs. Some work better with multiple JVMs. Some work better with a single JVM, but typically you'd scale up and you'd run multiple JVMs inside of a single machine, and these JVMs, as you'll see from the section in the back upon high availability, these JVMs can provide backup from each other, so if software components fail in one of the JVMs or the app servers, then the other one will take over the workload. Horizontal scaling takes a different approach. It says, okay, if we won't make the machines any bigger, we'll just have more of these machines. So you clone the machines horizontally, you scale out, you have two machines, four machines, six machines in a cluster, as many as you think you need, and you ideally deploy them with application server software, which is capable of managing clusters automatically without you having to replicate all of the definitions yourself, and products like WebSphere Application Server certainly do that. Slide 15 shows an SOA architecture pattern using many of the components that we saw on the first architecture slide. The SOA appliances inside the firewall in the DMZ, a portal server in addition to a process server to provide user-focused applications, the ESP server connected in with the process server and the application server, and everything else effectively providing the enterprise service bus, the smooth connectivity between all the components, and then the legacy and database servers, which may sit, you know, anywhere in the environment. Now, building this and getting all the pieces right really requires that you have an understanding of SOA principles, and quite a few people, people in IBM and outside of IBM, have written down some of the most important service SOA principles. For example, service contract, which requires that you document the capabilities of the service that you're going to be providing, that you effectively make a contract. It's going to accept these attributes. It's going to return these attributes. It's going to have these security requirements, these transactional requirements, and these performance service level requirements through things like XML policy. They're all part of the service contract, and they're placed in a repository, typically a service registry, and users and developers can go to that service registry to understand everything they need about the behavior and the non-functional requirements for that particular service. Similarly, service reusability says that when you build a service, you should build it not just for a single purpose, but for multiple purposes, which sometimes requires a little bit of extra thought and planning regarding not just what you may want from such a service, but working with others in the business to understand what they may want from such a service, and then building the service so that it has methods which are reusable and which can also be composed using service composability, which is another one of the principles, so that those service and the service operations can be composed into a workflow, if you like. Another very good architecture pattern for SOA is the enterprise service bus, the creation of a channel into which different clients and servers can communicate in whichever way they want, and the enterprise service bus will convert protocols, will transform messages, and will route messages dynamically to the place where they should be going. This removes a lot of responsibility from application programs, which no longer need to get bogged down into the sometimes non-reusable IT-related activities they do and focus on the business purpose for which they're being constructed. Now, when you construct such an SOA pattern, what you find is you're not just going to have one application server or one ESP server. You're going to have to cluster those just as we saw the J2E clustering environment. And again, you have those same decisions. Do you cluster vertically? Do you cluster horizontally? Or do you do some combination of both? Now, SOA patterns often come with anti-patterns. Well, don't overuse XML. You know, it may be very good, but it has performance implications, because it's typically expensive, especially on Z-series systems. Don't make your business services too small. Fine-grained is the term. What you'll find is they cost too much to execute, and they take too much work to use. So it focus the granularity of the business services that you're going to build on the granularity of the business operations that you're going to execute. And then you'll find that you get a certainly far better set of performing services than if you do the other. This is shown on slide 16, which talks about what I call chatty services, where you've got essentially very fine-grained service operations, and or your client applications are calling the services multiple times because there's no, for example, agglomeration capability, so you can't say, give me 10 orders, you have to ask for each one in turn. Now, what this probably requires, or the consequences of this, is performance tends to go down because you're not spending enough time doing real work, you're spending time trying to get the work done. You also need to put extra work into the applications in order to piece together these very fine-grained services. The answer is to refactor the application. This is what I was saying before when I was starting, that you may not find something out until the very end, and it forces you to do something that, you know, is really fundamental, like refactoring the design. And nobody wants to do that, so it's best to look early in the life cycle for problems like this. The diagram at the bottom right was taken using the IBM Web Services Navigator, a tool which is available on AlphaWorks, but also packaged complete with ITCAM for SOA. And what it shows you, having collected monitor data on a number of web service systems, a client, and some servers, what we can see is that there is a repetitive set of interactions. Each one takes a very small amount of time. They all go to the same services and the same operations on the services. And we're spending 7 seconds, as you can see from the scale on the right, doing work which could probably be done in half a second. So refactoring an application like that, understanding early enough in the life cycle what the effect of an existing design is, really is something that gives you a great start in deploying an application which is going to have some performance. The next slide shows another screenshot taken from the Web Service Navigator. This one shows a topology of service requests and the counts that each of the paths was taken. And this is representative of a customer lookup scenario where the client puts in a telephone number and a progressive search is made through the enterprise to find the number, resulting in, or to find the customer's name and address details, culminating in a lookup to a third-party service, which costs the company money. So obviously what we're trying to do is to do all the close lookups first, then sending a service off to another service which hosts a similar search on the enterprise, where we do the extra lookups. This is typical of a lot of customer situations, and what it shows is that you need to optimize the IT environment for the application design in a certain way. And the application design needs to have some understanding of the IT environment and some understanding of the costs involved, the time costs and the resource costs of getting to different services. So, for example, the customer lookup application doesn't start by sending the request to the enterprise customer service, and that doesn't start by sending the request to the third-party lookup, which may provide all the numbers, but is going to cost a hell of a lot more for the enterprise. They may be planning to spend 1% of their calls on external lookups. If you develop this application the wrong way, you still get the right answers coming out, but what you're going to find is that it's going to cost the enterprise 100 times longer, and it's going to take the customer longer to wait, because he's going to have to wait, you know, for 2 third-party lookups to happen before, you know, he can be served in the queue. So what you need to do is you need to recognize that mapping your SOA to a physical infrastructure is something, you know, that's really important, and that you need to look at the high speed, the local data sources first, the corporate response times, you know, next, and the third party services, which typically you pay for, you look at them last. Now, you can use capability like this from the Web Service Navigator, not only just to show you the topologies, but also to extract the patterns of use. You can then tie these in with the use cases that we use to define the application. And what you should find is that the number of execution patterns actually match the use cases that you're executing. The next chart has some best practice around understanding the cost of XML. If you don't know how large the XML messages that you're transmitting and receiving, then you may not be sensitive to this. This screenshot also from the Navigator shows the effect of transaction performance by sending large XML messages, which take longer to process on a given server. Moving on to development, especially in the area of J2E, you find that there are a lot of development best practices. There's a list of some key ones. There's a summary of the different types on slide 20. For example, the use of static versus dynamic pages. And then when you click the link, it'll take you to the page in the backup, and it talks about what some of those best practices are. Use an HTTP server. Don't do this using a file-serving servlet. There are far better ways to do it. Use things like the WebSphere plugin to route your requests, to manage the session data, to do load balancing, for example. On slide 21, something that helps is to profile your applications, to get an understanding of how they perform internally, how they're working internally, how one method relates to another, how one transaction relates to another. Understand the transaction paths through each individual application. Later on, you can do that through flows of applications and connectivity of applications. But even just getting an understanding of how an individual application works, especially in a WebSphere J2E environment, application profiling is really very helpful. It helps you to identify, for example, bottlenecks, packages which are most heavily used, so you can focus on optimizing the software which is used more regularly rather than something which you might guess is being used more regularly. What's also useful is if you can not only profile applications during the development environment, but also if you have a way of profiling applications running in the production environment, so that if problems do occur in production, if something slips through, whether it's performance related or not, you have a mechanism to monitor the flow of the methods within a J2E environment and then import it into the toolkit that your developers are using. That means you don't have to replicate that problem in test. The reason why it's probably happening is because your test environment didn't have a way of exposing it. And so it's very difficult to find such problems in test. So a tool which will enable you to drill down to the method level in production, collect data, and show it in the same sort of screen that your developers are using is very important capability. From a deployment perspective, we again have a range of different best practices. High availability, I talked about earlier on, horizontal and vertical scaling, mentioned in passing, talking about architecture. I'm going to talk about a couple here in just a little more detail, and the others I'll leave you to look at your leisure in the backup. The first one is pool funneling. This is most commonly used, or it's talked about recently in a J2E environment, but if we have any CICS systems programmers on the call, then I'm sure they'll recognize that these are exactly the same sorts of things that you do in a CICS environment, manipulating max tasks and active max tasks and DB2 connections and DB2 threads in a CICS environment. Basically, what you're trying to do is to hold work back until it's ready to do something useful and not have it hanging around in a queue for too long, too far down the line, because the further from the left to the right that you move in this picture, the more resources you're taking up within the system that you run the queue, until finally when you're executing, you're taking up a thread, you might have a connection to a database, you might have done an MQ put followed by an MQ get, and you might be waiting for some response while you're holding a connection. You know, you don't want to have too many applications like that sitting around. So ideally you set the database pool connections to something which will get your database running at capacity. you set your thread pool within the Web3 application server, something greater than that, but you don't want to have too many things queuing in the database because those resources are expensive. So you typically set up this environment, 100, 20, 10 is a reasonable start, but then you need to monitor it, because if you have too many things running at the same time, then the individual response times for any of those typically goes, and it tends to go up. So you want to monitor when your pools are reaching their thresholds so that possibly you can do some adjustment. You want to monitor how long people stay in different pools, and having monitoring tools which enable you to do this, like the IT Canvas WebSphere screenshot down below in the right, really helps you to have just the right sort of pool size so that you're not letting too much work in which will hang around and run ineffectively. So the next example looks at JVM Heap. JVM Heap is the way in which Java applications get their memory. They allocate memory from the heap, they free it. They allocate more, they free it. They allocate more, they free it. Now that's fine. When an application finishes, Java says, okay, all of his objects are free, I'll get rid of them. But sometimes it finds objects which haven't been freed or have got links into other objects which themselves are not free, and so the memory can't all be freed. And so what tends to happen in that environment is applications ask for more memory, and the available memory grows until it reaches a set limit. And once it reaches that limit and you try and ask for more objects and there's none left, then the Java environment says you can't have any more, and effectively everything comes to a grinding halt or crashes in a heap. And that sort of scenario is shown in the example, which is also from IT Camp for WebSphere, which shows an initially growing available but finally shrinking available pool, a typical scenario for a memory leak. The graph just below that shows how relatively late in the cycle the amount of CPU time performed doing memory allocation has grown from, you know, less than 1% to 8% and growing, and that's also a typical sort of environment. So getting your JVM heap right is critical. You set it too big, and on some JVMs, when it starts to do garbage collection, it locks everything out until it finishes the garbage collection. So you might think, let's have a huge JVM heap, but then you get these great gaps while it's doing its garbage collection, and everybody complains about that. Some later JVMs have incremental garbage collection, and that isn't a problem, but you really need to understand your JVM and understand how to set JVM heap, follow the best practices, and monitor it in production. And if you do have a memory leak, you need a tool to help you find it, and also IT Camp for WebSphere can help you find the memory leaks as well. So the next section is going to look at testing, performance testing. You know, why bother? You know, we've seen problems cost more to fix the further they go once they're deployed, once they're in production. You know, a hell of a lot more expensive to fix than they are if you could fix them in testing. So try and fix them in testing, improve your quality, maintain your image, do all the right things, but reduce the costs as well and give yourself more time to do new development rather than fixing the problems that you didn't catch the first time. So 29 overall, plans and fund performance testing, it is important. It's important to the enterprise. Think about the application context you're working in. It's a composite application context, so everything isn't all running on one box. You've got multiple boxes, and that's all part of your domain, and they're all connected in different ways, and you need to understand what all those different ways are. That said, you need to, you know, control as many of these variables as you can. You know, even though the application environment itself is going to bring a lot of variables, especially if you have complex environments, which is why you start small, you start on a simple test environment, and then you increasingly and systematically increase the complexity of the workload that you're running, and you increase the workload itself. And you don't start by just throwing everything at it in its most complex form. And all the time you do this, while you're testing, you're looking for problems, you're tuning up the environment, and you're documenting your findings so other people can benefit from your experience. couple of diagrams on the next slide. And I'm not going to go into these in great detail. You can read them. They're simple. You know, the project plan could map to many different functionalities. This one is test, diagnose, and tune. You probably need a project plan. If you don't have a standard, then, you know, this will help you. Have a lightweight methodology. Adopt this inside-out approach. Start looking at the diagram, the graphic at the bottom right. Focus on the application. Initially, make sure that you understand the application infrastructure is working on. Get that working. Look at a single path through the application. Start applying load to the application. And then finally, try and stress it until it breaks and see where it breaks and understand that. Start in the middle, work on out. Looking at the checklist on slide 31, who should be involved? Well, just about everybody. It's a composite application. It's spreading across multiple domains. The performance team is probably going to lead it, but you need to work with the application architect to understand how he thought the application was going to be deployed, what he thinks its performance is going to be. You need to work with application developers so that you can create scripts to help drive the application. You need to work with the database admin so that they can create all of the schemas and create utilities to build all of the data that you're going to need in order to test the application. And then a variety of sysadmins for J2EE and MQ and Message Broker, as well as maybe operating system-specific people to supplement the usually operating system-agnostic higher-level applications people. So, you know, basically you need almost everybody involved, certainly at some part of the operation. And then where should be done? It should ideally have its own environment, and that environment should ideally reflect the sort of environment that you think you're going to run it on in production. And if you're going to do cloning in production and scaling, then you really need to build that into the test environment as well. And ideally, you don't do any of this performance testing until the application has been tested and it's functionally working properly, because otherwise you get just fooled by a whole load of other problems. For load testing, you need to understand not just the daily variations, but the weekly variations, monthly variations, seasonal variations, and maybe understand how sometimes what's the daily variation during a different season, they may be different as well. So you need to plan for what you think is the average use, and then plan for some peak usages and build your test scripts, which will generate work which actually matches those normal and peak usages. When you're doing stress testing, on the other hand, what you're trying to do is you're trying to see where everything breaks. What's the buckle point of this application? When can I stop throwing anything at it? It either functionally breaks, you know, or the performance just goes down and down and down. And what you'll find is with a composite application, you'll have multiple buckle points. And what these will tend to do is they'll tend to break at the weakest links. So you need to understand what all the buckle points are across your entire deployed composite application. And sometimes keeping track of that can be difficult. So tools which will provide a decomposition of a transaction flow as it goes through J2E environments with servlets and EJBs and passes through systems into systems like CICS and DB2, that's really a very important way of understanding how the applications map to the containers, and the containers are the things which typically buckle. So on slide 32, there's a list of some of the test monitoring tools that you probably need. I won't go into them. They're there to be read. So now I'm going to look at some management best practices. Ideally, by this time, the applications have been well architected to SOA principles and to performance best practices. They've been deployed in an environment which meets their needs. They've been tested and any major performance problems have been identified and resolved. And now the environment is in production. And you now want to do things like you want to spot adverse trends in performance or in usage, so before these start to impact your end users. One of the problems is users report report most response time problems before the IT team knows that they're happening. And one way to get around that is to have a way that will generate synthetic transaction requests automatically on a time basis. So every 5 minutes you send in a request which accesses whatever key services you provide to your internal and your external users. If those services are suddenly starting to fail, you've set thresholds on those service requests, and the thresholds will result in changes on your dashboard and in events being generated to an IT event system. Or you may be caught out by usage patterns. You know, the things are getting busier, the market is more upbeat, the salespeople are doing well, the marketing campaign was a great success. All of these result in additional workload. IT capacity was set at a certain level, and you know, suddenly you find, wow, the response times aren't as good as they were, the CPU time is more than it was, everything is slower than it was. What's happened? You have the capability to do that within the tools, if you have the tools, that either let you look at historical results and you can see trends forming, and some of the tools like Tivoli Service Level Advisor will even project those historical data into the future and tell you when the performance problem is really going to hit you, when your service levels are going to stop being met. And they're the sorts of tools that you need if it's important to spot these trends. It's also important sometimes, well often, to use the right sort of monitoring granularity, I call it. Yes, it's useful to understand exactly what's happening in the production environment. Sometimes, though, that can be expensive to do. For example, method-level tracing is a relatively expensive operation. You don't want to do it all the time, and you don't want to do it on all methods all of the time. But some systems require that if you want to change your tracing options, you need to restart your application servers. So what you need is a tool that can change the monitoring granularity without having to restart the application servers. And the IBM tools enable you to do that and let you schedule, for example, at 8 o'clock we're going to set tracing to level 3, or when a particular transaction or when the 10th occurrence of a particular transaction comes in, then that will trigger method level tracing, or there's this particular transaction and when that one comes in, we're going to target that class and we're going to target that explicitly and we'll do the tracing for that. So to be able to respond automatically and change levels on the fly is really quite important. Sometimes one of the problems is that, you know, with monitoring tools, you have too much detail. You can't see the wood for the trees. You have physical views of the environment, and maybe you have an SOA or composite application system which is spread over 10 different servers, and it can be quite tiresome to walk up and down the physical tree piecing all these things together. Well, you don't necessarily have to do that, because most of the management tools around, certainly the Tivoli Composite Application Manager tools, provide you with an environment in which you can create logical workspaces and logical views. You can pull together metrics from different agents looking at different aspects. This is the web service traffic. This is the JVM internal traffic. This is the MQ traffic coming in and out of this environment. This is how the message book is running. You can build all of that in for an application into a single workspace. And as you see in the third one along at the bottom of slide 36, there's an example there where there's a graphic of an enterprise's real system, and superimposed on that are alerting points and metrics which enable you to see exactly what's happening on that system in your terms rather than in our terms. And also what happens often is, especially when you're in a cloning environment for scaling, you add new servers, and you then have to go and change all of your views in order to incorporate these new servers into views. With the Tivoli CAM products and ITM, you can do all that by associating server groups with logical workspaces, and then you just define or discover the servers which should be in those server groups, and the workspaces will be populated automatically. Messaging is also very key to composite application performance, whether it's the time that messages spend in queues, the time that they spend in the channels. The messaging environment really is, you know, it's a key piece of fabric. And if you don't track it to see what's going on, then you may be missing out on things. For example, if you find that the channel is down or the channel is failing all the time because of underlying network problems, that will affect the throughput of messages in your producing and consuming applications. If the channel is overloaded or if it's running on a slow network link, then you find that the throughput on the channel and the queues on either side of it start to build up. And if you're monitoring those queues, then that gives you an understanding of what you may need to do in order to improve the performance of the channel. Similarly, you can track the time that a message has been in the queue, and if it's been in the queue for too long, then the application which is feeding off that queue probably isn't performing as well or may need to be supplemented by running another copy of it, so both applications can drain the queue at the same time, or by running on a larger machine, or by changing some of the downstream characteristics of the application so that it does perform better. Or you recognize that having large queues for that particular application may be a normal state. All applications are different. It may be a normal state, but usually you don't want to have too many messages sitting in a queue in front of an application. It represents work as yet undone, and that's anathema in our business. Slide 28 gives you a sort of a high-level checklist for what you may want to do when you're monitoring an MQ environment. I think this would apply to probably any messaging environment, or when you want to configure a messaging environment as well. Ideally, you look for tools which provide the capability of not only monitoring, but also doing configuration and changes to those queues. Slide 39 shows how you can use a Megamon XE for messaging to track queue full conditions and delayed message conditions, both of which are caused by applications which usually aren't responding or aren't taking the messages off the queue. You need to be alerted for these. And the next slide has a list of some of the production monitoring tools that you may need in order to manage and monitor a composite application environment. What you'll notice is that many of these tools are very similar to tools that you needed in the test environment. So if you can choose tools that you use in both environments, that means that your users don't have to have two sets of tools, they don't have to have two sets of learning. When they go and support the operations people, as they often do, they are effective immediately and don't have to be trained on the tools that the production people use. So that can be a great help. And having tools which provide you all of the views from a composite application environment using the same user interface, the Tivoli Enterprise portal, using the standard workspaces which are provided, or by building logical workspaces, as I talked about just a few minutes ago. This is very important. To be able to take a complete view of composite application management, looking not just at the high-level, possibly newfangled SOA stuff, but the underlying application components running in J2E environments, running in CICS, the database component, the operating system component, the messaging fabric, linking it all together, to be able to see all of that and do historical reporting on all of that is really quite a powerful capability. Slide 43 has more, and I won't talk to all of that. Slide 44 also talks more about what we can do in Tivoli. And finally, slide 45. So what we've seen is that if you adopt best practice approaches right from the beginning, from the high-level architecture, modeling, and design phases, at the time when you're doing the development and the assembly of your applications, at the time when you are deploying the applications, at the time when you're testing them, which is hopefully before you've done the deployment, and also in the manage phase, you can get the best from your tooling and you can get the best from your applications. It's not a one-way cycle, it's a never-ending cycle, because information that comes from the manage phase, even once the applications are deployed in production, then goes back to help optimize the model, It can go back to help to optimize the development of the assembly, and it's often used to help to optimize the deployment environment. So it is a true iterative life cycle. So where do you get help? You can get some help from best practices. You need to choose them wisely. You need to look at them carefully in conjunction with the way things might have changed. As we move through, for example, the J2E standards, best practices change from J2E version to J2E version. And some of them have counter patterns and have anti-patterns, which may suggest that it's not always the best thing to do. So some best practices, choose them wisely, get some good monitoring tools, get them to help across the life cycle, not just in distinct parts of it. Get some good consulting and training if you need it. And if you want to know anything more about some of the product technology that I've used to highlight some of the best practice points that I've been making today, then you can go to the IBM Tivoli website at the URL on the slide. At this time, I'd like to close the presentation and hand back to the moderator because I think there's time for some questions.
Thank you, John. Before we take your questions, we would like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key followed by the number that corresponds best to your choice. We ask that you please listen to all options before making your selection. Our first question, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. And if it was low, press star 3. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone a chance to signal. Our next question, was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference at the right level? Please press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. And if you need more technical information, please press star 3. We'll pause for another moment. Our third question, do you have applications that span distributed and mainframe infrastructures? If yes, please press star 1. If no, press star 2. Again, we'll pause. Our fourth question, what tools do you have to monitor WebSphere application server? If CA Wiley, press star 1. If Mercury Interactive, press star 2. If Tivoli, press star 3. If other, press star 4. And if none, or you don't know, press star 5. We'll pause for just another moment. Our final question today, we hope you have enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you are interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If you would like, please press star 1, and if no, press star 2. And we'll pause one more time. And that concludes our survey. Thank you all very much for your participation. Now let's move to your questions. If you'd like to ask a question today, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone at any time. Once again, that is star 1 on your touchtone telephone if you'd like to ask a question today. And I would like to turn the call over to John while we wait for questions.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. If you have any questions, I'll wait a second and see if there's a question from the listening audience.
And there are no questions at this time, but once again, please press star 1 to ask a question today.
Okay, I did receive a question by email. It said, I spoke about doing transaction decomposition. But how do you do that? How do you monitor the performance of transactions which spread into other systems which aren't supported by the tools? For example, my custom application. So that's this is really quite a good question. The technology that we use in Tivoli is called ARM, A-R-M, Application Response Measurement. It's a standard which generates correlatable tokens, and these get generated on all of the hops along the way. And in the IBM Rosia technology, these are generated automatically by the WebSphere system, and Tivoli places instrumentation points in other systems like DB2 and in Siebel. But if you have your own applications, you can ARM instrument them yourself, and we provide a toolkit called the Build to Manage Toolkit, and you can find some more information on the Tivoli website about that. So that's how you can do that, and whatever your systems are, you can link them into the overall web servlet J2E environment, or even just monitor them on their own. Okay. Do we have any questions?
There are no questions at this time, but a final reminder to press star 1 to ask a question. And there are no questions today, John. I'll turn the call back to you for any additional or closing remarks.
Well, I'd just like to thank you very much for listening. I understand that there'll be an MP3 and the PowerPoint slides will be available on the website, I think, within a couple of days. So once again, thank you for listening, and I'll say good night.
Once again, thank you all very much for joining us today. That does conclude today's conference. Have a great day.